From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. This past Saturday, close to 5,000 people attended a rally on the steps of the Utah Capitol calling for more legislative action with respect to the Salt Lake Valley's air polluters and air quality.
Matt Pacenza is the policy director for Heal Utah and was one of the keynote speakers at the event. He joins us in the first part of the show to talk about the event itself and the growing movement by the public for industry, the legislature, and the public itself to begin doing something about the valley's polluted air.
All right. And in the second half of the show, author Ken Wishnia joins us to discuss his new book, The Glass Factory. It's a private detective crime novel. But in this case, the killer is industrial pollution, and the detective may be one of its victims.
Mystery novels are new material for us, Chris.
Yes, exactly. A little stretch, but we could do it.
That's right. So we'll talk to Ken about his book, but also about how fiction can play an important role in helping to explain environmental stewardship and environmental crimes.
All that and some news on Pete Seeger's passing, the environmental activist, among other things. Nell will share it with us, a little story she has with respect to Pete. The connections between DDT and Alzheimer's, a new study showing the linkages there. And if we have some time, some Sundance news, some summaries about the people we had to interview.
That's right, how they fared at the festival.
And a couple of films we saw, some environmental docs and our impressions on that.
That's right. And then, of course, you can always join in on our discussion today by posting your questions or your comments to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth, or emailing us at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
The environment, our connections with it, and impacts upon it. It's This Green Earth, and it all gets started right after these words from our underwriters. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Tim Henney. Join us for The Mountain Life Wednesdays at 9 a.m.
From the science of willpower to exploring the teenage brain.
From bike fit to relationship alignment.
From embracing imperfection to going gluten-free.
Join us for conversations with the experts on health, fitness, and lifestyle.
It's The Mountain Life Wednesdays at 9 a.m.
Brought to you by Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation.
Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa.
Park City Clinic.
Grand Valley Bank.
And Park Meadows Country Club.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak, co-host, of course, Nell Larson. And joining us on the phone, our first guest is Matt Pacenza. He is the he manages policy agendas for Heal Utah. That's Healthy Environment Alliance of Utah. And he's here to talk to us. He's actually at the Capitol this morning. And he'll explain why he's there to talk about some of, among other things, some of the air quality issues and some of the things coming up, hopefully, with respect to the legislature, some bills. Matt, thanks for joining Chris, Nell, and me on This Green Earth.
Good morning. Good morning.
We know you're on a cell phone, so we'll keep our fingers crossed that we got a good connection. Sounds good so far. And we appreciate you taking the time to chat with us. So first, you had a chance to speak at the rally this past Saturday. Said there was some 5,000 people that attended this rally. What do you think the overall tone of the event and some of the takeaways from it were?
Yeah, I think, you know, first of all, it was extraordinary to see that many people there, and certainly it was the largest rally. About environmental issues in the 7 or 8 years I've been living here in Salt Lake. So it was historic and really just heartwarming for all the folks who came out on a Saturday afternoon and, you know, to raise their concerns and their fears in a lot of ways. You know, we have a pretty serious wintertime air pollution problem down here in the Salt Lake Valley. And little by little, the sort of anger and outrage and concern and fear have been building. And, you know, we've had a couple real bad winters in a row here. And people are fed up with it, and they look around, and by and large, I think they see what I might call half measures, you know, sort of nibbling at the edges and sort of incremental steps, which, you know, to be fair, there are some positive things happening. But I think people are fed up, and they They want, you know, big change and, you know, powerful policies, and it's being that yet. So, you know, the idea was to gather all these folks together and, you know, with sort of one voice, really, you know, demand a more urgent action, and, mm-hmm. and that's our goal.
Mm-hmm. Matt, it looked like this event was a partnership between several different organizations. Can you talk about who organized it?
Yeah, I mean, the main folks involved were Dr. Brian Mensch with Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment, a young man named Carl Ingwell, who primarily works with a University of Utah Clean Air Student Network, Tim Wagner with the Sierra Club, and then a bunch of other folks, including HEAL and other groups. So, you know, there's a pretty big, robust nonprofit environmental community here in Salt Lake. Oh, I also left out Utah Moms for Clean Air, so right. Definitely played a big role as well. So there's a bunch of groups, and, you know, some like HEAL have staff and are, you know, sort of able to work on an array of things. Other groups are more volunteer-driven, and so it's a bunch of actors, but, you know, we came together for this.
Right, so let's talk about this group called the Clean Air Caucus, a group of legislators. Are they both Democrats and Republicans? Uh-oh. Oh, man, are you there? Oh, I think we lost him. Cell phone. Cell phone.
And they're officially gone.
The wonders of cell phone tech. We'll try to get Matt back. He'll call in a little bit. He's down, like I say, he's down at the Capitol this morning. There's a number of bills that are being introduced by a group that calls themselves the Clean Air Caucus. And actually, there's 15 that I saw as I was doing some research on it, including some bills that want to change up. There he is. Yeah, I think he's back with us. Matt, are you back with us?
Yeah, I'm not sure what happened there, but I'm here.
Okay, well, I was wondering about who the Clean Air Caucus is, a group of legislators. They're both Democrats and Republicans?
Yeah, that's correct. So, you know, last year's, the 2013 legislative session coincided with a really bad wintertime inversion. So you had several legislators. I think the first ones involved were Representative Patrice Arendt, a Democrat from Middle Creek. And I believe, I don't want to get the name, don't want to not credit the right person, but mm-hmm. I think Representative Ed Redd, a Republican from the Logan area, was also one of the early ones involved. And then Joel Briscoe and Rebecca Chavez Houck, Democrats from Salt Lake, were soon involved too. And it's grown to the point where there's probably about, I'd say, 12 to 15 of them, perhaps even more. And they've been sort of informally meeting here at the Capitol over the past year and discussing possible solutions. There's been parallel efforts happening as well. There was a task force that was partially charged with looking at clean air issues. And so those varied efforts and, I think, continuing citizen pressure have led us this session to have somewhere around, as of right now, at least 17 or 18 bills focused on clean air. So it's super exciting that, you know, they're not all like amazing, fantastic bills, but a number of them are pretty great. And, you know, we're going into this session with optimism, which is frankly not always the way we approach these.
How about that? Yeah.
We like that. So yeah. It looks like these bills cover a really wide array of, or address a wide array of issues. What's, why don't you highlight a few of them for us so we know what to look for?
Yeah, there's one that doesn't have a number yet, but I believe it's called, the names swim together a bit, but I believe it's called Clean Air Amendments, or it might be called Clean Air Revisions, but its sponsor is a Republican, Becky Edwards, who represents Bountiful. And what it would do would, it would remove a piece of state law which currently exists, which forbids the Department of Environmental Quality from making any air rules that are stronger than the EPA. So the way it works now is, like, we can't do better than the EPA on anything without – this sort of gets complicated, but the only way we can is if we do sort of our own original research and health studies, and it's essentially a burden that has been deemed too significant to ever clear. So it's prevented us, as we look at it, as sort of providing, you know, Utah solutions to Utah problems, and if we need be, you know, coming up with, you know, perhaps here and there some tougher controls. So that's a significant obstacle to progress, and Representative Edwards' bill would remove that. So that's one we really like. Patrice Arendt's got a couple good bills. One would establish a state-level sustainability coordinator, mm-hmm. and that person's job would effectively be to marshal the resources of state government. State government's the biggest employer in the state, sort of by far, and some of the agencies do a pretty good job reducing their own pollution emissions and dirty air contributions, but some of them, frankly, don't do a very good job. And we saw reports from all of them this past year, and there's definitely some low-hanging fruit that a bunch of these agencies can do, so that if that person's position is created, that'll be their job to sort of make all that happen. There's a bunch of transportation stuff, various incentives and tax credits and the like to get people in transit, make electric vehicles more popular,
right?
Natural gas school buses, a bunch of stuff like that too. So those are a few highlights.
Yeah, the one here, House Bill 41, is sponsored by Representative Handy, a Republican from Layton, would allocate $20 million for matching funds to replace 170 school buses manufactured before 2002 and build alternative fueling stations, natural gas or so. So that's encouraging. And like I said, bad air doesn't discriminate. It affects both Democrats and Republicans' lungs. So there's motivation on both ends, including our own representative here, Craig Powell. No, the Republican.
For sure.
And it is interesting that Representative Edwards, that you mentioned, her bill to change the existing language that says that the state can't implement federal air quality regulations that are more strict than federal regulations, something this state typically is anathema to do, right? As a, you know, the federal, how dare the feds put regulations on us? But in this case, hey, it's the feds, you know, it's their regulations. We can't go below them. And in case, yeah, for PM 2.5, we should consider going below the federal regulations.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it in that front, it's all about the geography. You know, we have, you know, we're in this soup bowl here, and you know, we got these mountains ringing us, and stuff just gets trapped. And so because of that unique consideration, we might need to go, you know, beyond where they go from time to time. And, you know, there are plenty of American cities that make a heck of a lot more pollution than Salt Lake City, but ours gets trapped.
Right.
And so that's why we might need to have, you know, pick what it might be, cleaner gas or a tougher regulation on a particular industry or, you know, consumer products or small businesses, whatever the particular rule might be, you know, we might need to go a notch better. And our position, and I think Representative Edwards as well, is that, you know, give the regulators that option. You know, they may not choose it. They may deem that's not necessary, but it's kind of silly to tie their hands.
Right.
So looking at all these different strategies, you know, looking at our old cars or old school buses or, you know, the industrial activity in Salt Lake, like where is Heal Utah focusing? Do you guys have a preferred strategy for attacking this air quality issue?
You know, not particularly. I think we Heal's roots go back to some basically air polluted air issues, which was in the West Desert back in the kind of mid to late 90s when the organization was founded. So it's kind of where we come from. And for a while there, as you folks know, and I think many listeners, you know, we were most associated with nuclear things, you know, nuclear power and nuclear waste. And then in the last couple of years, you know, folks really asked us to get more involved. And, you know, our strategy has been to find things that other groups aren't doing and to try to do them well. And so far that has involved, the first thing we did was to try to drive support for new EPA rules that are about cars and gas. And so those are called Tier 3 standards, and they would, when they go into effect, and it's going to be a while, but in the 2020s, they'll fully go into effect. Like, our cars will be a lot cleaner, and that in the long run is going to be a huge help. And then we got involved with urging the state to have a tougher plan in place to reach those 2.5 goals, that fine particle pollution goals, and that essentially involved urging them to crack down more on industrial pollution. But each of those cases, it wasn't necessarily that we said, well, this is the answer. It was more that we just spotted an opportunity where we thought we could sort of do what we do and bring citizen pressure to bear and all that kind of thing. So I think it's just about, you know, leveraging whatever, you know, strength or power that we have in smart strategic ways. And the truth is that if anyone tells you there's one answer to dirty air, they're lying. Yeah, there's not one answer. It's a bunch of things. And, you know, we just try to pick a few of them and work on them.
Hey, if you just joined us, we're speaking with Matt Piacenza. He's the policy director with Heal Utah. We're talking about some of the bills that are proposed to with respect to air quality and air pollution issues down in the valley and across the state. And Matt is there at the Capitol to cover the unveiling of some of these bills. One of them is interesting. It's a bill that would ban the incineration of medical waste within close proximity of schools and homes. And obviously, we're talking about Stericycle. So, a bill to address the Stericycle issue. What do you think the chances of that one are passing, Matt?
Yeah, well, it's a complicated issue because we have sort of a lot of things happening at the same time with that. And I should add that EEL has not worked a lot on it directly, and, mm-hmm. and the Utah Physicians Group has a lot. And then there's a local community group of folks who live near there, I think called Communities for Clean Air, and they're terrific, and they've been really fighting that fight. But to make a long story short, there appears to be a deal in place to move it mm-hmm. and to move it from this North Salt Lake sort of bountiful neighborhood to the Tooele area, kind of the West Desert area. And so this bill would certainly make something like that happen because it couldn't stay in North Salt Lake bountiful area because they'd be too close to schools and neighborhoods. But I think parallel to that, there's another effort involving like state incentives and stuff, which would push them to some, I think, state land in the Tooele area. So the community of folks who fought it in North Salt Lake are pretty determined to keep it from reopening somewhere else. So it's kind of an ongoing thing. And, you know, I think it's kind of one of those stay tuned things. But if folks want to find out more, I'd recommend, you know, looking up that Communities for Clean Air group.
Okay.
So you mentioned that, you know, there is already a little momentum on air quality issues and there are already some good things happening. Tell us about, you know, the current action on that front.
So aside from the legislature, kind of other stuff?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, I think, you know, there's a couple noteworthy things. I mean, Governor Herbert in his budget proposed some things. And so you folks mentioned that bill to convert school buses. That is a Gary Herbert initiative, which is, you know, being carried forth by a legislator. He also has proposed some money for some research and some health studies, I think, or actually, no, some health studies and some education. And so all told, it's over $20 million. And that's significant. I mean,
yeah.
We've not had new appropriations from Gary Herbert, certainly since, you know, I've been around. And then there's a lot of corporate stuff. There's a lot of kind of business-led stuff, a lot of efforts to get big employers to, you know, make transit easier to happen, you know, whether that's just buying their employees the passes or, you know, there's like van pools and car pools and shuttle buses, a bunch of that stuff kind of kicking around the private sector, and the Chamber of Commerce, the Salt Lake Chamber of Commerce does a real good job on that. And then, you know, you have the public education front. A lot of this is the choices individuals make. And there's, you know, there's an effort to spend money to encourage people to drive less, to do this thing called trip chaining, which is where you know, on a bad air day, if you got to run some errands, like do them all back to back, because the worst thing you do as a driver is when you first start your car. When you first start your car and it's cold is when you're putting a bunch of the gunk in the air. So what the worst thing you can do is sort of, you know, 3 hours apart, four times a day, take four little trips. That really magnifies your contribution. So there's that kind of thing. There's wood burning. So we've become increasingly aware that burning wood down here in the valley is just a dreadful idea in the winter.
Right.
So there's education efforts in place. There's some incentive stuff where they would help people replace a wood furnace with a natural gas one. So there's a lot. There's a tremendous amount of activity. And, you know, I think time will tell whether we're sort of willing to make the big changes and sort of sacrifices and, frankly, spend money. I mean, the truth about mass transit is that we've got a pretty good spine for a system, as everyone says. Trax is a good spine. But now what we need to do is really invest in buses and have buses that run a lot more places and a lot more often. And that, frankly, just requires money. It requires millions of dollars, probably tens of millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. And so far, the leaders at the state level are not really willing to do that, to consider tax hikes, gas taxes, you know, various things like that. So,
right.
You know, in the long haul, you know, there's talk of the population of the Salt Lake Valley doubling. And in the long haul, if you're going to have that kind of highly urbanized area, you got to really have these big, significant investments in a different kind of place. And you know, we're not seeing that so far, but I think a lot of the small to mid-sized steps are definitely happening, and you can definitely take some encouragement from that.
Okay.
That's great to hear. So if some of our listeners are interested in getting involved with this clean air movement, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, obviously, I have to start with our organization, so healutah.org, you know, healutah.org, and obviously we've got the Facebook and the Twitter and stuff, and so we, you know, we do a pretty good job of staying in touch with people and emailing them and letting them know about opportunities to come to an event or a rally or a hearing or contact your legislator. And then, you know, there are a bunch of other groups, so you can, you know, look at Utah Moms for Clean Air and the physicians, and there's a Clean Air Now Facebook group that really thrives. And so there's a bunch of stuff out there. And I think the key is to, you know, let us tell you the best opportunity to get involved, because there is a lot going on, but we'll let you know about that key hearing or the key moment to contact your legislator and all that.
Perfect.
Okay. And while we have you, Matt, I can't help but ask you to give us a little quick little update on what's going on with the Green River Nuclear Power Generation Station proposal for that. What's the latest?
Yeah, so we, you know, we lost the court decision. So we went to court to try to overturn the state engineer's decision to approve the transfer of water rights for the reactor project. And we had a trial for a week in Price, Utah, in the end of September. And our attorneys, who are actually Park City folk, John Flinton and Laura Swenson, did a terrific job. And unfortunately, the judge chose to not overturn the state engineer's decision. Mm-hmm. So in a somewhat complicated legal thing, we are waiting for that decision to be formally issued, which will happen in a month or two, like probably February or something. And then we have 30 days to appeal that. So that's the technical place we are. And we haven't decided yet whether we'll do that. The bigger picture is that, you know, so far they have managed to get some of these approvals, but the bigger picture is that they don't have the resources to move forward. They've really have been rather unsuccessful in attracting investors or utilities willing to buy the power. So frankly, we're pretty confident in the long haul this thing has a really very little chance of moving forward, because the electricity just costs too much and no one really wants it. But
right,
they're kind of, you know, they've had a few successes and they're kind of stumbling forward a bit. So we'll keep an eye on it and we'll keep people posted.
Right. I mean, their successes are in the areas of receiving approvals or permits from the state to say, well, you know, we don't object to you building a nuclear power plant. Now go try to find the money to build a nuclear power plant. That's the challenge.
Well, that's well said, and I think that a lot of state officials, frankly, are skeptical, but they figure, well, they don't really need to say no to it because it'll probably just go away on its own merits, and that's frustrating for us because we'd rather not have to spend resources to fight it. But, you know, the truth is that during the trial, we learned stuff about their finances, and they just don't have a lot of money, and they haven't attracted much, so right. We're not too worried, but it's sort of just something to keep an eye on.
Oh, yeah. You don't want to ignore it. Right?
Right.
That's exactly
right. I do want to.
You would prefer to ignore it. So,
right.
But you're doing great work, Matt, over at HEAL, Utah Healthy Environment Alliance of Utah. Again, thanks for taking the time to chat with us about some of these clean air bills. It's all very encouraging. You know, last year at this time, how many bills were being introduced with respect to air and air quality?
Yeah, two, three.
So,
yeah.
So it's a 5 to 6-fold increase.
The momentum is building.
Of course, it's been a 5 to 6-fold increase in bad air. So there's probably a direct relationship between the two. But you know, sometimes that's a great mover and shaker. So again, Matt, thanks for joining us on This Green Earth, and I'm sure we'll stay in touch to get some more updates from you.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Nelia. Much appreciated.
Okay, let's take a break for some underwriters. And when we come back, we'll be talking to our second guest, Ken Wishnia.
Right.
He's the author of a environmental fiction.
That's right. Our first foray into
novel. Yes.
Mystery novels, fiction.
Join us to talk with Ken about his book, The Glass Factory. It's This Green Earth. And we'll be back right after these words from our underwriters.
Park City Restore is grateful for the many hands that have made it successful. Your gift of time means more affordable housing services are available locally through Habitat for Humanity. Plus, volunteering at the ReStore gives you a first look at the amazing treasures donated for resale. Learn how you can get involved at habitat-utah.org. Click on the big yellow volunteer button. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch Counties is a nonprofit organization.
Park City Realty Group is a proud sponsor of KPCW's Mountain Money. This is Mike Mazzoni, principal broker and owner of Park City Realty Group. 100% locally owned and operated, Park City Realty Group provides boutique real estate services to buyers and sellers in the area. 649-1991 or parkcityrealtygroup.com.
This is Tom Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we're happy to support KPCW. Prudential Utah has been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976. Our agents know the community and the local market. More information can be found online at prud-utah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, the weekly talk show on environmental issues and our relationships with it. She's Nell Larson. I'm Chris Cherniak. And on the phone with us is Ken Wishnia. He is the author of an environmental crime novel, we'll call it. It's called The Glass Factory, a Filomena Buscarcella mystery, one in a series that Ken has written. Ken, thanks for joining Nell and me on This Green Earth.
Thanks for having me.
Let's just start here. Why don't you, for our listeners, lay out the land of this book and what it's an environmental crime novel is about.
Well, sure. I guess the key thing you mentioned, it is a series, and environmental crime features throughout the series. I'm fortunate to actually have gotten to high school with someone who's now very high up in the U.S. EPA, and she's been a direct pipeline for me to all kinds of data that, you know, is in fact theoretically in public domain, but really, if you asked through the Freedom of Information Act, it would take 20 years to get it.
Uh-huh.
So I get all this information directly from the source, and I guess the key thing is, a lot of activists always read nonfiction, and you can read environmental impact reports. But for a lot of people, I think fiction affects them in a way that nonfiction doesn't. I think there's a Stalin-era Soviet general is famous for having said, you know, one death is a tragedy, 10,000 deaths is a statistic. And it's the goal of a fiction writer to make that one person real to you. So one of the things I do in here is I take a lot of, you know, real scientific data. Mm-hmm. This is specific to Long Island, in this case, in New York. And I actually, you know, put you through recognizing a fictional family and the troubles they go through. Because, you know, I think often in film, in something like, Aaron Brockovich, we celebrate the individual sort of drops everything to take up this fight. And one of the things I go for in this novel is, you know, my main character is a working woman. She doesn't have time. You know, she does put as much as she can into the fight, but how many of us can actually drop everything and do this? So, I try to present, you know, the complexities of, how can citizens take action? And one of the approaches, of course, one of the advantages I have of working in the crime genre is I get to have a heroine who acts in a sort of superhuman way that the rest of us can't. You did a great job pronouncing her name, by the way. Most people do not get Filomena Buscarcella right.
Really? Well, it's the A, I'm from New Jersey, and B, I'm
there you go.
Partly Italian, so although she's Ecuadorian, she's a private investigator that's Ecuadorian, and Ecuador. It's interesting. Ecuador has its own environmental issues with respect to Chevron and oil, but that's a whole other story. Maybe
that's
a whole
another show
book for you,
yeah,
Ken.
So, Ken, I'm curious as to how you found yourself writing these kinds of novels. You know, tell us about your background.
Well, sure. I mean, obviously. you know, yeah, my family was very political. You know, my parents raised us. I was, like, carried to my first protest marches because I was too young to walk. I think these would have been early civil rights and early anti-Vietnam War protests. So, you know, that goes way back. But also, you know, for me, there are a lot of practitioners of the crime genre, and some are attracted to it for very different reasons, to sort of celebrate law and order type culture. So that's one, you know, part of the genre. But I was always attracted to it because, for me, it's the one popular genre in the U.S. that has a long history of political commentary, you know, going back as far as Dashiell Hammett in the 1920s. One of my favorite metaphors of his from his first novel, Red Harvest, says, you know, the room was as dark as an honest politician's prospects.
you know, oh, that's amazing.
So, you know, as far back as the 20s, he's using crime fiction as a way of, you know, commenting on the corruption in the society. So, you know, yeah. I mean, I think nobody wants to read a political tract disguised as a novel, so I go to great lengths to make the characters engaging, and I'm sure you notice there's a lot of humor in it as well.
Right.
But, and it also allowed me to, you know, rather than just describe, oh my God, the workers are dealing with these horrible conditions where exposure to these chemicals will cause, you know, these such and such effects, you know, which you could get from, you know, reading an article in the alternative press, this is set up as a revenge story. Just, you know, briefly, since you asked your first question, it was a little bit about the novel. In the first novel in the series, my character is exposed to what is supposed to be a deadly dosage of methyl isocyanate, which is, you know, an ingredient in pesticides,
right,
and, you know, nearly kills her. And, you know, in this one, basically, you know, chapter one ends with her, you know, coughing up blood and realizing and being given an ultimatum that, you know, yeah, she's got inoperable cancer, and so she decides to take revenge on the person who did this to her. So she ends up asking questions that sort of like, and how much exposure to this would kill somebody?
Right.
You know, so instead of, as I say, presenting it as, you know, just sort of a factual reporting, you know, I'm embedding the environmental data, you know, in a crime story where someone's actually asking this to try to find out, gee, could I kill somebody by,
right,
you know, holding their head down in a vat of this stuff?
Right.
So, and, you know, again,
and reading, I was saying, reading the book, you learn about PCBs and TCE and DDT, which actually we're going to
in
talk a little bit
morning.
In the news this morning with its potential connections to Alzheimer's. And so you learn a lot of chemistry, and you have a character who is from the EPA who helps forward that narrative and explain some of the chemistry and the science behind all this.
Yes, I think I'm pretty unique there. I mean, when was the last action-adventure film they made with someone from the U.S. EPA? Heroic role there. Come on, Hollywood, get with it. You know?
Exactly.
Call me up. You guys found me. But, you know, you mentioned DDT, and in fact, again, for you folks there in Utah, I'm here in Suffolk County, New York, on Long Island, which actually, yeah, you know, it was one of the first places to, you know, ban some of the chemicals way back in 1970 because, you know, we had potato farms in the old days that took up half the island, and they used tons of DDT. And as I'm sure many folks know, you know, we do have higher than average breast cancer rates in the area. And, you know, we take it very seriously here on Long Island. It's a very, you know, densely packed area. It's not urban, but, you know, for suburbia, it's very dense. And as we know, there's a lot of dismissal out there of environmental realities, and you know, even though, you know, Suffolk County was once, you know, very conservative, back in 1972 it gave Richard Nixon the highest plurality of votes of any county in the country, including his home county, yet people are taking these environmental risks very seriously. So, you know, I think if we can get something to cut across political lines like that, I think that's a real challenge we're facing right now. I know you take on these issues all the time, but, you know, when there's sort of global warming denial, you know, it's really hard for me to understand that. I mean, I understand why some people do it, of course, because, well, you know, they make money from, you know, traditional carbon-based sources of energy, and they don't want people turning to other things. And, you know, they pay lots of pundits to, you know, repeat that, and apparently they pay lots of politicians to repeat that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's their job to muddy the waters and get lots of regular people to think it's a hoax. And for me, I guess especially, as you point out, there's lots of science in this. There's several scenes in the chemistry building at a large state university somewhere on the north shore of Long Island. And, you know, I'm just really astonished by that trend, you know, to just, you know, on what planet do you think, you know, 99% of scientists are all involved in this conspiracy
yes.
to, you know, promote a hoax that, you know, there's global warming? Like, what could they possibly gain from that? I mean, if you think about it for a second, like, what is their motive? You know, I understand the motive of, I don't agree with it, but I understand the motive of, you know, pundits and politicians who are basically paid by, you know, the oil and coal industries to deny global warming. But, you know, I don't understand how people sit there and are convinced that, yeah, scientists are in it for themselves in some way. You know, I don't get that at all.
We're right there with you.
I have two words, Al Gore. There you go. That's why.
Can you extrapolate on that?
Well, he's just such a polarizing individual, and many people feel like if Al Gore is for this, I'm against it. I don't care what.
Right.
So
right.
It can be a very fundamental reasoning like that. Otherwise, it is complicated.
Well, one of the things I like about the crime genre, and I've done this because, you know, obviously, you know, a lot of police officers, you know, do tend to be, you know, socially conservative. They go into law and order. But, you know, one of the things I respect about, you know, cops is, you know, typically, you know, in spite of, you know, prejudices and all that, though, but what if you actually present them with evidence, you know, they will follow that. And so that's the thing. You know, at some point, you know, they all have their prejudices. You know, we all profile in our way. I mean, if you're walking along a dark street at night and you hear footsteps behind you, you're going to turn around and do a quick instant profiling and go, okay, little old lady with a cane, you know, she's probably not, you know, a Soviet era agent with a poison tipped umbrella coming after me. You know, you're going to do that, but that's something I go for in the crime novels. You know, there's a character in The Glass Factory who, you know, it takes place in the early '90s during the presidency of somebody named Clinton, I think, very vaguely I can recall that. So you know, there's a World War II veteran in there, you know, because of course now the veterans in their 80s and 90s. So, you know, back then, you know, there were 70s and 80s. And so, of course, yes, he's very socially conservative and he, you know, enjoys sort of torturing my main character, who's a very, you know, outgoing female. And yet, you know, my character empathizes with him. She just sort of, I guess I would say, you know, my character shows some growth because in the first novel in the series, she's a much more headstrong, a younger woman, much more headstrong. And, you know, if somebody had let out a comment about, oh, you women's liberties, which that too is just such an archaic phrase, but, you know, this guy uses it, you know, right. She would have launched into a 3-page rant. Whereas in this book, you know, she needs his help. She knows ranting at him isn't going to get her anywhere. You know, I've got to work with this guy. You know, so she swallows it up. But, you know, again, you know, that's something I'm trying to go for, saying, you know, we can bridge these gaps in mutual crisis. And I think, you know, it's a key thing because, you know, really, at what point are we talking about our survival? And, you know, doesn't that cut across, you know, race, class, and political lines?
Right.
You know, I know, you know, in the environmental movement, you know, people talk about the survival of the planet. And I remember reading somewhere, you know, somebody essentially saying, the planet's going to keep going no matter what we do. It's humanity that might not survive.
Sure.
You know, and that's a concern. So
do you think that, you know, are there any plans in your next books to take on some, it sounds like you focused on, you know, toxics and chemicals in this current book, to take on things like, you know, global warming, climate change, big issues like that?
Certainly I'm working on the research for my next one, and I think this comes to the fore. I'm certainly planning on, tapping my mole at the EPA.
Mm-hmm.
Since I spent a lot of time working on a different novel set in the 16th century, so I was not using her for a while, so she's got a ton of backup information. But sort of what I was talking about before, one thing that truly, you know, fascinates me is sort of the effect of propaganda, you know, or what we now call spin, you know, and so that's something I'm certainly going to focus on, you know, just how do you convince people to vote against their own survival? You know, you've got to convince, at the very least, you want to muddy the waters. You know, you may have mentioned that I teach at a community college here on Long Island. I do a lot of introduction to literature and, of course, freshman composition. We sometimes take on some hot-button issues. So, you know, last year we were doing, you know, that if you actually, you know, there was this, you know, obviously very polarized Congress, you know, not moving, very divided 50-50 kind of thing, but that if you actually poll people, you know, this incredible majority believes that, you know, the way out of some of our current crisis is, you know, increase taxes on the rich so that you can provide more for the poor, certainly for Medicare, you know, and Social Security. You know, and I had a student write saying, you know, we shouldn't be giving handouts to people. And, you know, I had to say, you know, Medicare is not a handout. Right. Social Security is not a handout. You know, we pay into that all our lives. But I did say, that's exactly what they want you to do. They want you to confuse the things. They want the water is muddied. You know, so this is, you know, so I guess sort of that's what I want to focus on is, yes, obviously some of the issues, but more just the way the issues get spun, and again, especially if you can muddy the waters, if you can convince people that, you know, whatever gun control advocates want to destroy America, you know, how do you get from point A to that, you know?
Right.
So, you know, that's, and obviously with the environment, you know, what's just happened in West Virginia is the kind of stuff I've been putting in my novels for years. You know, you've got people who are, you know, dependent on the coal industry for survival. And you know, again, you can't just shut down the coal industry and put all these people out of work. You know, that's savage capitalism. You have to, you know, in a sane society, we would phase it out and give them new jobs in the new clean energy industry. But, you know, right now you have this.
Well, no, there's no shortage of material going forward in the environmental air arena for you, Ken. The name of the book is The Glass Factory, by Ken Wishnia. It's put out by PM Press, and it's available in paperback right now. Ken, we want to thank you for taking the time to chat with Nell and me on This Green Earth, and good luck.
You. Thank you for having me.
All right. Hey, let's take a break for some underwriters, and when we come back, we'll talk some news items on Pete
That's
Seeger,
right.
DDT, and our take on Sundance. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
This is Chris Robinson with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we've been supporting KPCW since day one. Prudential Utah helps buyers and sellers with their home needs, whether it's a condo, single-family house, or undeveloped land. Our agents know our community and our local market. More information can be found at pru-utah.com.
Hi, this is Carrie, local owner of Spigot Design and dedicated supporter of KPCW and KPCW.org. Spigot provides custom website design, development, and content services for your website, making it accessible across desktop, tablet, and mobile devices. Located in Quarry Village, Jeremy Ranch, or online at spigotdesign.com.
This is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage services provider and a proud sponsor of KPCW. Summit County residents are recycling more and more, currently nearly 6 million pounds per year. Recycling helps keep Summit County clean. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and that's Chris Cherniak across the board.
Yes.
And we're back to bring you some news highlights or lowlights, I guess, maybe from the week. But let's start, having just talked about a novel taking on toxic chemicals, let's start with our DDT story.
Oh, yeah. Just in today's
oh,
paper,
yeah, that
a study that's basically suggests a linkage between Alzheimer's and exposure to DDT. You know, I don't get into the science. I don't think I understand the science deep enough to explain it well. But basically, a study that suggested that in a number of Alzheimer's patients, there were high levels of either DDT or one of the breakdown products of DDT, which is DDE. in their bloodstream, these Alzheimer's patients compared to a control group who do not have Alzheimer's. So kind of a statistical relationship, but also a chemical relationship showing a connection between DDT and its ability to produce proteins or plaque or other chemicals that have an influence on the presence or development of Alzheimer's. So it's really interesting. But you know what's interesting is that DDT, didn't we ban that back in the 70s?
Right,
yes,
right.
We did here in the U.S.
But it's
other
still being
countries
used internationally.
All right. So,
and I thought it was interesting. You know, the authors of the paper were saying we're not suggesting banning this worldwide because it's still the most effective way to get rid of malaria. And you know, if it's a life or death situation with malaria, you have to deal with those immediate needs. You know, rather than a chance of increased Alzheimer's 30, 40 years down the road. So, you know, they suggest looking at alternatives and looking for alternatives in the future, but, you know, they don't say ban it.
No. Actually, it's been found to be very effective against bed bugs, too.
Oh, boy.
So, you know, DDT is a powerful, effective chemical, but it also has environmental and public health impacts. And it persists. It has a very long persistence rate. It can last in the soil, stay in the soil for decades. And when we ingest it, it can remain within us or, its breakdown products for decades. That's why it's still showing up in the blood of these people who are 60, 70, 80 years old. So interesting little take there on DDT and Alzheimer's. We'll see what comes of that. Next story. Want to do Pete Seeger?
Yeah. So from time to time, Chris and I will talk about things that kind of got us into the environmental field or inspired us. And I think we saw in the news this morning that Pete Seeger passed away at the age of 94 yesterday. And he was known really well, obviously, for his folk influence and his knowledge of folk history and songwriting and all of that. But he was also an environmental activist.
Right.
And in the 1940s, he actually purchased some land right on the Hudson River and built a log cabin there. And the Hudson River became one of his one of his focal points for his environmental issues. And so he then in the 60s, when the river was really a mess, full of PCBs that were being dumped by GE, full of raw sewage, untreated wastewater, he initiated the building of a sloop that would model historic sloops that would be placed on the Hudson River to focus on environmental issues and bring attention to environmental issues. And that was called the Clearwater. And I grew up in the sort of along the Hudson River in northern New York State. And we always used to go – we would go on field trips on the Clearwater boat when I was growing up to learn about the issues and learn about the watershed and learn about what water quality is. Yeah. And so this was just something that I wanted to mention today. He was a big environmental activist and had a huge impact in that field.
And motivated you. Was he on the boat?
That's right. No, I didn't get to meet him.
No?
He was not on the boat teaching the, I don't know, third graders about the water quality.
Right.
But
you
it
remember
was
that
legacy,
and you
yeah.
take that away and that resonates with you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Going forward and then say, you know what, I want to pursue first an education. Right? You
went yeah,
you did
absolutely.
Go to, you did go to college.
I did go to college.
You tell people that, right.
And focus in environmental studies.
Environmental studies at Yale.
That's right. And then I kept going in to do my master's in environmental
sure,
science.
Sure, why
well.
Not?
That's right.
That's college for.
What's yes. It's like, this, need a little bit more than that.
I need a master's.
Yeah.
Mom and dad. So can I stay? Yeah. So I did the same thing. But that was a great motivator for you.
Yeah.
Pete Seeger. Well,
absolutely.
He'll be,
so we wanted to recognize his environmental activism today.
Great. Good job. All right. We got a few more minutes. Let's talk about our Sundance experience.
Yeah.
You saw a film?
I did. I saw one of the films whose directors we interviewed. I saw Marmato, which is about gold mining in a small Colombian mountain town. And they're looking at the environmental and the social implications of larger companies coming into this small town to take over the mining and do it in a very different way. And it was a well-done documentary and really fascinating and riveting. And like many environmental documentaries, a little bit depressing.
Sure.
Yeah.
You just learn to accept that after a while. You just you develop an immunity to it.
Thick, a thick skin.
And just take away the lessons from that.
That's right.
Okay. So that was a good film.
It was a good film. I would recommend people seeing it.
We had a nice chat with the director of that. I saw Overnighters, a documentary about the North Dakota oil boom and how that boom is straining relations between local citizens and the literally thousands of people, mostly men, unemployed men, who come to town looking for work in the oil fields. And there's literally no room for them. So they come here with maybe a backpack full of clothes and in a dream, you know, that type of thing,
right,
on buses and trains. And the towns are overrun with these men. There's no housing. There's no hotels. The trailer parks are full. They're sleeping in parking lots. And the story is really about a pastor of a local church who attempts to accommodate these overnighters, as they're called. And the strains that are set up between the pastor and his congregation, the church and the local town, the neighbors who don't like these and trust these men, some of which have, shady backgrounds in past and troubled backgrounds. And so it's a really fascinating and real quick, the film was fantastic, and it won a special jury award for intuitive filmmaking. The access that these filmmakers had to not only the pastor but all these other characters was fantastic. So I highly recommend it. I hope it gets picked up. For like the 17th consecutive year, somebody we interviewed was also
right.
Won an award.
That's right.
Michael Rosado Bennett, director of Alive Inside.
We like to think we have something to do with that.
He was a winner, Audience Award for the best U.S. documentary. How about that?
Really,
congratulations,
really cool
Michael.
Topic.
And finally, Todd Miller, the director of Dinosaur 13. We interviewed them, and Dinosaur 13, although it didn't win an award, it got picked up already by CNN. And it'll be shown as one of their documentaries on that station.
So everyone will get a chance to see that if they'd like. And then we wanted to mention that Scott Hodierne, who we had interviewed in the past about his short film, received the Director Award for the full-length film in the U.S. Dramatic Film Competition.
Yeah, Fishing Without Nets. It was a fantastic short when we interviewed him. Remember? I was so excited. That film was great. And they turned it into a full-length feature. Congratulations. Scott.
Right.
All right, let's take our last break and wrap up for a couple more underwriters, and we'll be back. It's This Green Earth.
Enjoy stand-up comedy at the Historic Egyptian Theater this weekend. Headliners Vince Morris and Dwight Slade promise to provide our best stand-up comedy show of the year. Humor elevates the soul and warms the heart, so get your tickets at parkcityshows.com or at the box office at 328 Main Street. They're just $19 and up. The Egyptian Theater is a hilariously nonprofit organization.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. It's time to wrap up. But first, we got to promote our next week's show.
Yeah, we've got two great guests lined up. First, we'll be talking to Cornell professor and award-winning author Harry Green, and he'll actually be here in town to do a talk and a book signing at the Swanner Eco Center that evening. His last book was a New York Times Notable Book Award, and he'll be talking about the book he just released, talking about both his research on snakes, actually, and the experience of doing it.
Super. And then the other guest is Dr. Devra Davis. She's an epidemiologist and the author of a couple books, including When Smoke Ran Like Water. She grew up in Denora, Pennsylvania, which had one of the worst chronic episodes of air pollution ever recorded in the U.S. People actually died from this episode. She'll be here to talk about that and other air pollution issues. A lot to learn from her. So great show next week. Don't forget to join us for that. But let's thank our underwriters for whom this show would not be possible. They include
Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough.
Republic Services.
Habitat for Humanity's Restore.
Rocky Mountain Power.
San Francisco Design.
And Prudential Utah Real Estate. Don't forget to join us on Facebook, This Green Earth. This is KPCW Park City.